Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Music, Facts, and Figures, a podcast by Mark Inesito. I am Mark Inesito, and it's been a while since I did my last podcast. I'm not gonna lie, it's been a kind of an interesting few months. One big thing we did a couple months ago, my wife and I, is we purchased a new dog for our house, a new addition. We wanted a big dog, you know, because we have two Chihuahuas, and we wanted a big dog. One of our other dogs, we had to put her down when she passed away. She was a half Chihuahua, half Italian Greyhound. My wife always called her a Chihuahua on stilts, but yeah, we had to put her down when she wasn't doing too well. So we got a new dog about a month later exactly. This is what we put our Chihuahua Italian Greyhound down in July, and we got a new one in August. We got a Canaan. That's the proper way of saying it. Canaan's actually the national dog of Israel. You know, we have to think of names to call her. We have a friend of our family friend, my wife's family actually. He's from Lebanon. And we asked him, what would be a good name for a dog from Nashville, who's the national dog of Israel? And he gave us the name Zara, which means queen. So that's the name Zara. She's really cool. And I had a friend on Facebook kind of ask me, in the next podcast episode, should have her as a guest. I probably will once I get my YouTube podcast going, which I'm gonna announce now. I think I announced last time too. This podcast is not going to be on YouTube, so it's just going to be on audio. That's it. In fact, next two are going to be on audio as well. So this one and the other two, this is going to be on only audio only. No YouTube. So please bear with me on that. Labor Day weekend wasn't too great for us. My wife and I got COVID. And, it was just rough because I was looking forward to going to a barbecue. And, couldn't go. It is what it is. They say shit happens, right? But yeah, that's about it. And I'm going back to school again, fall semester. Almost finished, which is good. I can't wait till I get my bachelor's. Something I wish I did after high school, but it is what it is. And my dogs aren't here in the bedroom right now, so if you hear them in the background, I apologize, but I know they're kind of playing. Two of them are kind of playing. Zara and one of our Chihuahuas. But yeah, this time got away from me, and that's my dogs. Yeah, this time got away from me, and here I am. Hopefully, this will be good. I'm excited about this podcast. I'm excited about the next two podcasts as well, and I'll announce that here in a short bit. Let's get started, actually. Yeah, so I'm continuing my series, The History of Music. I'm in 1967. The Summer of Love, as I call it. I'm in May of 1967 still. And today I'm going to talk about the album. This is part one of a three-part episode. I'm going to do podcasts about the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Perhaps one of the greatest albums of all time. It's been on numerous lists as the number one album of all time. Rolling Stone magazine did a countdown three times. Once in 2003. Again, I believe in 2010 or 2000. I can't remember. 2011, 12. I don't remember when it was. Around that time and another time around 2020, maybe 21. The first two times, number one album was the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was a great album. Honestly, it was historical, it was iconic, even the cover was iconic, it was different too, it was different as opposed to what we heard in the past from the Beatles. Like, Rubber Soul from 1965 was a different album, because they started using sitars and stuff, and kind of was a bit folky and a bit away from the, She Loves You, yeah, that stuff, more like the writing for themselves now. Revolver got a little psychedelic on there. It was different. This was completely different. I mean, when you hear Rubber Soul Revolver, you can pretty much hear the early Beatles still on there. But this one was completely different. You know, it had various elements of rock, music hall, classical, if you will, pop standards, psychedelia, things like that. It was an Indian music, classical Indian music. You know, it was a great album. And going back to those lists, I want to mention one thing about those Rolling Stone, the 500 greatest albums of all time. I can't even think of 500 albums. You tell me. You know? But twice it got number one. And, in fact, the third time when they did the countdown, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On was number one. So, yeah. So, let's get started. So this first part's going to be about the album itself. Part two next week, hopefully. I'm going to promise when I'm going to make it. Hopefully next week, I hope. It's going to be more about the album cover. In part three, I'm going to focus on one song from the album. A very iconic, epic song. The final song on the album. A Day in the Life. Which I'm going to talk about it during this episode too as well. And if it sounds repetitive, in 2 weeks from now. I apologize in advance, but there'll be some more information that I didn't mention today, so that's definitely a plus on that one. So let's get started. This is part one of the Beatles Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and it's about the album itself, and let's get it rolling. As usual, before I start, I want to announce my source for this episode. I'm going to be reading from the book, The Beatles Anthology, which is quotes from the Beatles themselves. So, it was published in 2000. So, yeah. But first off, though, before I can go into the book here, I wrote a little synopsis on the album. A brief synopsis, and it's what I know from the album. It's basic, and this is what I know of the album. I'm going to read it first and go into the book. The idea for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came from Paul McCartney. A source states that after a trip to San Francisco and hanging out with bands such as Jefferson Airplane and Grateful Dead, the whole surreal long-named bands came to mind. Other bands from San Francisco had interesting surreal long names such as Moby Grape, Quicksilver Messenger Service, and Big Brother and the Holding Company, to name a few. Paul was also inspired by two albums from 1966 as well, Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys and Freak Out by Mothers of Invention. Freak Out was considered as rock's first concept album, an album that follows a storyline. The Beatles recorded the song first before the idea of the album came to mind. Paul wanted the Beatles to become a fictitious band as an idea was a concert of songs. The opening would welcome the crowd and introduce the audience to the band. The ending would feature a goodbye of sorts, stating that it's time to go through an encore. And what an encore it was. Okay, let's continue in the book here. John Lennon. The people who have bought our records in the past must realize that we couldn't go on making the same type forever. We must change, and I believe those people know this. I've had a lot of time to think. And only now am I beginning to realize many of the things I should have known years ago. I'm getting to understand my own feelings. Don't forget that under this frilly shirt is a 100-year-old man who's seen and done so much, but at the same time knowing so little. Paul McCartney. We were now in another phase of our career, and we were happy. We'd been through all the touring, and that was marvelous, but now we were more into being artists. We didn't have to be performing every night, so instead we could be writing or chatting with our mates or visiting an art exhibition. For instance, John and Yoko would have never met if we hadn't had all that time spare for him to look around exhibitions and bang a nail in. Having the time off gave us a lot of freedom to come in with crazy ideas. I spent a lot of time listening to avant-garde artists and going to places like Wigmore Hall, where I saw the composer Luciano Berio. I remember meeting him afterwards, and he was a very unassuming bloke. George was into Indian music. We were all opening our minds to different areas, and then we'd come together and share it all with each other. It was exciting because there was a lot of cross-fertilization. John Lennon. Sgt. Pepper was Paul after a trip to America. The whole West Coast long-name group thing was coming in. When people were no longer the Beatles or the Crickets, they were suddenly Fred and his incredible shrinking Grateful Airplanes. I think he got influenced by that. He was trying to put some distance between the Beatles and the public, and so there was this identity of Sgt. Pepper. Intellectually, that's the same thing he did by writing She Loves You instead of I Love You. Paul McCartney. It was the start of the hippie times, and there was a jingly-jangly hippie aura all around in America. I started thinking about what would be a really mad name to call a band. At the time, there were lots of groups with names like Laughing Joe and his Medicine Band, or Colonel Tucker's Medicinal Brew and Compound. All that old western going around on wagons stuff with long, rambling names. And so, in the same way that in I Am the Walrus, John would throw together Choking Smokers and Elementary Penguin, I threw those words together. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I took an idea back to the guys in London, and we were trying to get away from ourselves, to get away from touring into a more surreal thing. How about if we became an alter ego band, something like, say, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts? I got a little bit of a song cooking with it, that title. John Lennon. How can we tour when we are making stuff like we're doing on the new album? We can only do what we're doing. We've toured. That was then. If we do another tour, we'll probably have to hire London for one big happening. And we have us and the Stones and the Who and everybody. Excuse me. Everybody else on it. Hey. Come on, guys. Unless that happens, forget it. I don't want to be a mop top. For those that want mop tops, the monkeys are right up there, man. Paul McCartney. At the moment, we have an act to suit the ordinary type of tour that goes on. If we could think of a way of getting four flying saucers landing on the top of the Albert Hall, it would be possible. But at the moment, there isn't much happening in that direction. John Lennon. I'm sorry. My dogs are playful. Well, my dogs are pretty much on the podcast, so one of them is. That's Jasmine, one of our chihuahuas. John Lennon. We didn't make any images for ourselves. You did the image making, the papers, TV, and all that. I never cared to toss about images. There's this big scoop about the new look Lennon being photographed at an airport or somewhere. Who cares? I don't. If some photographer wants to take a picture of me and say that I've changed, let him. I'm there. I'm only an answer to myself. Nobody else. Tour manager Neil Aspinall. I used to share a flat in Sloane Street with Mal Evans, another road manager. One day in February, Paul called saying that he was writing a song and asking if he and Mal could come over. The song was the start of Sgt. Pepper. At my place, he carried on writing and the song developed. At the end of every Beatles show, Paul used to say, "It's time to go, we're going to go to bed, and this is our last number." And they play the last number and leave. Just then, Mal went into the bathroom, and I said to Paul, "Why don't you have Sgt. Pepper as a comparer of the album?" He comes on at the beginning of the show and introduces the band and all, and at the end, he closes it. A bit later, Paul told John about it in the studio, and John came up to me and said, "Nobody likes a smart arse, Neil." Producer George Martin. The idea came about gradually. Basically, it was Paul's idea. He came in and said he had a song, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and that he was identifying it with the band The Beatles themselves. We recorded the song first, and then the thought came to make it into an idea for the album. It was at a time when they wanted to concentrate on the studio, and that probably fermented the idea of the alter ego group. Let Sergeant Pepper do the touring. Paul McCartney. He would be Sergeant Pepper's band for the whole of the album. We pretend to be someone else. So when John walked up to the microphone to sing, it would be the new John Lennon vocal. It wouldn't be the new John Lennon vocal. It would be whoever he was in this new group. His fantasy character. It liberated you. You could do anything when you get to the mic or on your guitar because it wasn't you. Ringo Starr. The album is always going to have Sergeant Pepper at the beginning. And if you listen to the first two tracks, you can hear it was going to be a show album. It was Sergeant Pepper and his Lonely Hearts Club Band with all these other acts. And it was going to be to run like a rock opera. Yeah, it started out with the feeling that it was going to be something totally different. But we only got as far as Sergeant Pepper and Billy Shears singing with a little help from my friends. Then we thought, sod it, just two tracks. It still kept the title and the feel for that. It's all connected, although in the end, we didn't actually connect all the songs up. John Lennon. Sergeant Pepper is called the first concept album, but it doesn't go anywhere. All my contributions to the album have absolutely nothing to do with this idea of Sergeant Pepper and his band, but it works because we said it worked, and that's how the album appeared. But it was not put together as it sounds, except for Sergeant Pepper introducing Billy Shears and the so-called reprise. Every other song could have been on any other album. I can't really get into writing Tommy. I read that Pete Townshend said that he had just a bunch of songs and they sort of melted into Tommy in the studio. It's like Sergeant Pepper. A bunch of songs and you stick two bits of pepper in it and it's a concept. George Harrison. I felt we were just in the studio to make the next record, and Paul was going on about this idea of some fictitious band. That side of it didn't really interest me, other than the title song and the album cover. Ringo Starr. Sergeant Pepper was our grandest endeavor. It gave everybody, including me, a lot of leeway to come up with ideas and try different material. John and Paul would write songs at home, usually or wherever they were, and bring them in and say, I've got this. The actual writing process was getting to be separate by now, but they come in with bits and help each other, and we'd all help. The great thing about the band was that whoever had the best idea, didn't matter who, that would be the one that we'd use. No one was standing on their ego saying, well, it's mine, and getting possessive. Always the best was used. That's why the standard of the songs always remain high. Anything could happen. And that was an exciting process. I got to hang out and listen to it unfolding, although I wasn't there every day. Producer George Martin. I've been involved in a lot of avant-garde type recordings, and I did a lot of experimenting in the early days, long before the Beatles, with electronic tracks and music. Concrete. I introduced the Beatles to some new sounds and ideas, but when Sergeant Pepper came along, they wanted every trick brought out of the bag. Whatever I could find, they accepted. Ringo Starr. As we got up to Sergeant Pepper, George Martin had really become an integral part of it all. We were putting in strings, brass, piano, etc., and George was the only one who could write it all down. He was also brilliant. One of them would mention, oh, I like the violin, and go dee dee diddle or whatever, and George would catch it and put it down. He became part of the band. John, Paul, and George, the writers, were putting whatever they wanted on the tracks, and we were spending a long time in the studio. We were still recording the basic tracks, as we always did, but it would take weeks to do the overdubs for the strings or whatever, and then the percussion would be overdubbed later and later. Sergeant Pepper was great for me because it's a fine album, but I didn't learn to play chess while we were recording it. Neil taught me. Neil Aspinall, world manager. George Harrison. It was becoming difficult for me because I wasn't really that into it. Up to that time, we had recorded more like a band. We would learn the songs and then play them, although we were starting to do overdubs and had done a lot on Revolver. Sergeant Pepper was the only album, was one album, excuse me, where things were done slightly differently. A lot of the time, it ended up with just Paul playing the piano and Ringo keeping the tempo. And we weren't allowed to play as a band so much. It became an assembly process, just little parts and then overdubbing. And for me, it became a bit tiring and a bit boring. I had a few moments in there that I enjoyed, but generally I didn't really like making the album much. I just got back from India, and my heart was still out there. After what happened in 1966, everything else seemed like hard work. It was a job, like doing something I didn't really want to do, and I was losing interest in being fab at that point. Before that, then everything I known had been in the West, and so the trips to India had really opened me up. I was in the whole thing, the music, the culture, the smells. There were good and bad smells, lots of colors, many different things, and that's what I've become used to. I've been let out of the confines of a group, and it was difficult for me to come back into the sessions in a way. It felt like going backwards. Everybody else thought that Sgt. Pepper was a revolutionary record, but for me it was not as enjoyable as Rubber Soul or Revolver. Purely because I had gone through so many trips of my own, I was going out of that kind of thing. Throughout that period, I was quite close to John, although people always say I saw the Lennon-McCartney aspect. We were the ones that had the dental experience together. Road manager Neil Aspinall. Spending 6 months on Sgt. Pepper did allow them to experiment more and take more time over the record. Sometimes being stuck together at the same place for too long can have an adverse effect. It can tend to be a bit disruptive rather than pulling things together. But that didn't happen. Everything was okay, although it did get a bit boring for me, really. John Lennon. I never took it, LSD, in the studio. Once I did, actually, and thought I was taking some uppers, and I was not in the state of handling it. I took it and I suddenly got scared on the mic. I said, "What is it? I feel ill." I thought I felt ill and I thought I was going cracked. I said, I must go get some air. Bill took me upstairs on the roof and George Martin was looking at me funny. Then it dawned on me that I must have taken some acid. I said, "Well, I can't go on. We have to do it and I'll just stay and watch." I got very nervous and just watching them all. And I kept saying, "Is this all right?" They had all been very kind and they said, "Yes, it's all right." I said, "Are you sure it's all right?" They carried on making the record. We didn't really shove the LP full of pot and drugs, but I mean, there was an effect. We were more consciously trying to keep it out. You wouldn't say I had some acid, baby. It's so groovy, but there was a feeling that something had happened between Revolver and Sgt. Pepper. Whether it would have happened anyway is pure speculation. Producer George Martin. I was aware of them smoking pot, but I wasn't aware of them and they did anything serious. In fact, I was so innocent that I actually took John up to the roof when he was having an LSD trip, not knowing what it was. If I had known it was LSD, the roof would have been the last place I would have taken him. He was in the studio and I was in the control room and he said he wasn't feeling too good. So I said, "Come up here and ask George and Paul to go on overdubbing the voice. I'll take John up out for a breath of fresh air," I said. But of course, I couldn't take him out to the front because there was 500 screaming kids who would have torn him apart. So the only place I could take him was to get fresh air was the roof. It was a wonderful starry night and John went to the edge, which was a parapet about 18 inches high, and looked up at the stars and said, "Aren't they fantastic?" Of course, to him, I suppose they would have been especially fantastic. At the time, they would just look like stars to me. I suppose I was a big brother to them. I was 14 years older than they were. I guess I was straight, and they knew I disapproved very strongly of drugs, although I'm afraid I used to smoke cigarettes, and that's pretty well as bad. I never smoked pot in front of them. They never smoked pot in front of me, and they used to nip down to the canteen below and have a little drag and come out giggling a bit. I knew what they were doing, but it didn't make any difference. Ringo Starr. The song "With a Little Help from My Friends" was written specifically for me, but they had one line that I wouldn't sing. It was, What would you do if I sing out of tune? Would you stand up and throw tomatoes at me? I said, there's not a chance in hell I'm going to sing this line, because we still have lots of really deep memories of the kids throwing jelly beans and toys on stage. And I thought that if we ever did get out there again, I was not going to be bombarded with tomatoes. John Lennon. Paul had a line about a little help from my friends. He had some kind of structure for it, and we wrote it pretty well 50-50 based on his original idea. Ringo Starr. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and all the madness that it went around, it was absolutely bonkers. I was actually with John when Julian came home with this little kid's painting, a crazy little painting, and John, as a dad, said, "Oh, what's that?" And Julian said, "It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds." And then John got busy. Paul McCartney. I showed up at John's house, and he had a drawing Julian had done at school with the title Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds above it. Then we went up to his music room and wrote the song, swapping psychedelic suggestions as we went. I remember coming up with cellophane flowers and newspaper taxis, and John answered with things like kaleidoscope eyes and looking glass ties. We never noticed the LSD initial until it was pointed out later, at which point people didn't believe us. John Lennon. I saw Mel Torme introducing a Lennon McCartney show saying that how Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was about LSD. It never was, and nobody believes me. I swear to God, or swear to Mile, or to anybody you like, I had no idea it spelled LSD. This is the truth. My son came home with a drawing and showed me this strange-looking woman flying around. I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds." And I thought, "That's beautiful." I immediately wrote a song about it. And the song had gone out. The whole album had been published, and somebody noticed that the letters spelled out LSD. I had no idea. And of course, after that, I was checking all the songs to see what letters they spelled out. They didn't spell out anything. None of the others. It wasn't about that at all. The images were from Alice in Wonderland, and it was Alice in the boat. She is buying an egg, and it turns into a Humpty Dumpty. The woman serving in a shop turns into a sheep, and the next minute, they're rowing in a rowing boat somewhere. And I was visualizing that. There was also the image of the female who would someday come save me, a girl with kaleidoscope eyes who would come out of the sky. It's not an acid song. George Harrison. I like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. A lot. John always had a way of having an edge with his songs. I particularly like the sounds on it, where I managed to superimpose some Indian instruments onto the Western music. There were specific things that I had written, like Within You, Without You, to try to feature the Indian instruments, but under normal circumstances, that wouldn't work on a Western song like Lucy, which has chord changes and modulations, whereas tambouras and sitars stay in the same key forever. I like the way the drone of the tamboura could be fitted in there. There was another thing during the vocals in Indian music. They have an instrument called a sarange, which sounds like the human voice, and the vocalist and sarange player are more or less in unison in the performance. For Lucy, I thought of trying that idea, but because I'm not a sarange player, I played it on the guitar. In the middle eighth of the song, you can hear the guitar playing along with John's voice. I was trying to copy Indian classical music. Paul McCartney. There are all sorts of ideas. Let's use some bass harmonicas on this, or let's use comb and paper on this. Hey, we used to do this when we were kids. That's a laugh. George Harrison. John got the idea for Mr. Kite when we were filming in Seven Oaks in Kent. We had a lunch break, and we went in an antique shop. On the way to the restaurant, we were looking around when John came out of the shop with a little poster which had more or less the whole lyric of the song being for the benefit of Mr. Kite on it. John Lennon. It was from this old poster from the old-fashioned circus from the 1800s, and that I bought at an antique shop. We'd been filming a TV piece to go with Strawberry Fields Forever. There was a break, and I went into the shop and brought an old poster advertising a variety show which starred Mr. Kite. It said the Hendersons would also be there, Leda Pablo Fankos Fair. There would be hoops and horses and someone going through a hogshead of real fire. Then there was Henry the Horse. The band would start at 10 to 6. Oh, at Bishop's Gate. I hardly made up a word, just connecting the lists together, word for word, really. I wasn't very proud of that. There was no real work. I was just going through the motions because we needed a new song for Sgt. Pepper at that moment. I had to write it quick because otherwise I would have been on the it wouldn't have been in the album, excuse me. Later there were all kinds of stories about Henry the Horse being heroin. I never seen heroin at that period. George Harrison. Within You Without You came about after I spent a bit of time in India and falling under the spell of the country and in music. I had brought back a lot of instruments. It was written at Klaus Voormann's house in Hampstead after dinner one night. The song came to me when I was playing a pedal harmonium. I also spent a lot of time with Ravi Shankar trying to figure out how to sit and hold a sitar, how to play it. Within You Without You was a song that I wrote based upon a piece of music of Ravi's that he had recorded for All Indian Radio. It was a very long piece, maybe 30 or 40 minutes, and was written in different parts with a progression in each. I wrote a mini version of it using sounds similar to those I discovered in his piece. I recorded it in three segments and spliced them together later. John Lennon. Within You Without You is one of George's best songs, one of my favorites of his too. He's clear on that song. His mind and his music are clear. There is his innate talent. He brought that sound together. Ringo Starr. Within You Without You is brilliant. I love it. John Lennon. George has done a great Indian one. We came along one night and he had about 400 Indian fellas playing there, and it was a great swinging evening, as they say. John Lennon. When I'm 64, it was something Paul wrote at the in the Cavern days. We just stuck a few more words on it, like grandchildren on your knee and Vera, Chuck, and Dave. It was just one of those ones that he had, that we've all got, really. Have a song, and this was just one of that was quite a hit with us. We used to do them when the amps broke down just to sing it on piano. Paul McCartney. There is a story in the paper about lovely Rita, the meter maid. She just retired as a traffic warden. The phrase meter maid was so American that it appealed to, and to me, a maid was always a little sexy thing. Meter maid. Hey, come on and check my meter, baby. I saw a bit of that, and then I saw that she looked like a military man. The song got played around with and pulled apart, and I remember wandering around Heswell, where my dad lived and my brother now lives, trying to write the words to it. I pulled them all together, and we recorded it. John Lennon. He makes them up like a novelist. You hear lots of McCartney-influenced songs on the radio. These stories about boring people doing boring things, being postmen or secretaries and writing home. I'm not interested in writing third-party songs. I like to write about me because I know me. I was writing A Day in the Life with the Daily Mail propped in front of me on the piano. I had it open to their news in brief or far or near, whatever they called it. I noticed two stories. One was about the Guinness here who killed himself in a car. That was a main headline story. He died in London in a car crash. Paul McCartney. John got he blew his mind out in a car from a newspaper story. We transported it a bit. Blew his mind out was a bit dramatic. In fact, he crashed his car. But that's the what we were saying about history. Malcolm Muggeridge said that all history is a lie because every fact that gets reported gets distorted. Even if the Battle of Hastings, King Harold didn't die with an arrow in his eye, that's just what the Bayeux tapestry says. They put it in because it looked better. And now if you research Harold, you'll find that he was off somewhere else, playing Shea Stadium, probably. John Lennon. On the next page was a story about 4,000 potholes in the streets of Blackburn, Lancashire. There was still one word missing in that verse when we came to record. I knew the line had to go. Now they knew how many holes it takes something to Albert Hall. It was a nonsense verse, really, but for some reason I couldn't think of the verb. What did the holes do to the Albert Hall? It was Terry Doran who said, fill the Albert Hall, and that was it. Perhaps I was looking for that word all the time, but couldn't put my tongue on it. Other people don't necessarily give you a word or a line. They just throw it in the word you're looking for anyway. Paul and I were definitely working together, especially on a day in the life. The way we wrote a lot of the time, you write the good bit, the part that was easy, like, I read the news today, or whatever it was. Then when you got stuck, or whenever it got hard, instead of carrying on, you just drop it. Then we would meet each other, and I would sing half, and he would be inspired to write the next bit, and vice versa. He was a bit shy about it, because I think he thought it was already a good song. Sometimes we wouldn't let each other interfere with a song, either because you tend to be a bit lax with someone else's stuff. You experiment a bit. Paul's contribution was the beautiful little lick in his song, I Love to Turn You On, and that he had a floating around in his head and couldn't use. I thought it was a damn good piece of work. Paul McCartney. John and I sat down. He had an opening verse in the tune. He got the idea of how it would continue from the Daily Mail, where there was a mad article about the holes in Blackburn. Then the next article would be the Dame so-and-so had played the Albert Hall. So they all got mixed together in a little poetic jumble that sounded nice. Then I threw in a little bit I played on piano, woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head, which was a little bit party piece of mine, although I didn't have any more written. Then we thought, oh, we'll have an alarm clock to start it, which we did on the session. We got Mal Evans' account, 3, 4, 25, and then the alarm went off, and we knew that was a cue to go into the next bit of the song. We just divided it all up. There was also the big orchestral build-up. I just sat down and thought, oh, this is a great opportunity. This is the song, man. It was a crazy song anyway, and I love the turning on and lots of psychedelic references. We could go anywhere with this song, and it was definitely going to be in big places. I started to try to sell an idea to John. We take 15 bars, just an arbitrary amount, and then we'll try something new. We'll tell the orchestra to start on whatever the lowest note on their instrument is, and to arrive at the highest note on their instrument, but to do it in their own time. We actually put that in the score. From here, you're on your own. I had to go around all the session musicians and talk to them. You've got the 15 bars. If you want to get the go together, you can. The trumpet player is always famous for their fondness of lubricating substances. They didn't care, so they'd be there at the note ahead of everyone. The strings all watch each other like little sheep. Are you going up? Yes, so am I. And they go up a little bit more. All varied and delicate and cozy. All going up together. But listen to those trumpets. They're just freaking out. The result was a crazy big swing storm, which we put together with all the other little ideas. It was very exciting to be doing that instead of 12-bar blues. The whole album was made like that. At that stage, we had just discovered stereo, which was just coming in. So we panned everything everywhere. I remember we'd asked why there was always little breaks between the songs on the record. The engineers told us they were traditionally 3 seconds long, and they were there so the DJs could get their records lined up. We thought you could put something in there, little funny sounds, and then we heard the engineers talking about frequencies. And we asked about them. They said, well, you've got a low and high frequencies. Only your dog can hear the highest ones. We said, you're kidding. Then they told us that people had experimented with low frequencies as weapons. You can blow a city away if the right frequency is strong enough. So we thought, well, then we've got to have a little bit in there that only dogs can hear. Why just make records for humans? It got a bit insane, and everyone added a bit more. You put those bits on the end of the record just for a laugh, really. Let's have a little bit from Martha and Fluffy and Rover. John Lennon. Was that the one, A Day in the Life, that everyone thought was something obscene and never was? If you play it backwards and all obscene, but we had no idea. It was just one of those silent things. I like to meet the man who banned this song of ours. I like to turn him on what's happening. Why don't they charge you electricity board with spreading drugs, because to get electricity you have to switch on. Hidden messages. Everything depends on the way you read a thing. If they want to read drugs in our stuff, they will. But it's them that's reading it. Them. Ringo Starr. People think things are hidden on the album. No, I didn't think anything was hidden. We did a lot of animal noises, but a lot of the talking that was on there was the only there because the state of the art was pretty primitive at the time. If we talk on the track, you could never get rid of it, and it would be moved onto the next track as you jump across. We did some talking that was absolutely up front. We all went out and talked on the mic and turned it backwards. It was not as if it was that secretive. All those people who play records backwards and get something rude that should play it the right way, and it probably says something really nice. Producer George Martin. In terms of asking me for particular interpretations, John was the least articulate. He would deal with moods, he would deal in colors almost, and he would never be specific about what instruments or what line I had. I would do that myself. Paul, however, would actually sit down at the piano with me and we work things out. John was more likely to say, as in the case of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, it's a fairground sequence. I want to be in that circus atmosphere. I want to smell the sawdust when I hear that song. So it was up to me to provide that. And that's all I have about the album, in their own words. It's a great album. I mean, I heard it. I don't know how many times I heard it, but yeah. I mean, so when I talked about John Lennon having the acid trip in the studio, that was during the song Getting Better. So that's funny. During the song called Getting Better, and John has to get better to come back and record again. Because he's having the acid trip. So, and there's a story, too, about another song on the album. Paul McCartney's Fixing a Hole. I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets... You know what I mean, right? There's a story about that song. I guess Paul was at his house getting ready to go to the studio. Someone came to his door, and the guy introduced him as Jesus, and he says, well, I'm going to let you in. Come on in. And he invited this person in, and they talked a bit, and they both went down to the studio, and he sat there doing a recording of Fixing a Hole. And that they went out, got tea, and hung out. And as Paul McCartney said in the quote, that was the last we saw of Jesus. And another story about the album, when Bob Dylan first heard it, he was like, turn it off. He didn't really care for it. So, yeah. So, that's all I have for today's episode. Next week, again, I'm going to talk about, it's going to be part two of Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's going to be about the album cover now. I'm going to go through the same book, the Beatles Anthology book, do their own quotes about the album cover. It's such an iconic cover, too. I mean, it's one of the most well-known covers of all time. I mean, you can go to a record shop and go, oh, Sgt. Pepper's. Yeah. So, yeah, that's next week, the album cover. So, thank you for tuning in. I appreciate it. If you like my podcast, please listen to me on apps such as iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And check out my YouTube channel, which is titled Music, Facts, and Figures, a podcast by Mark Anastito. Please subscribe if you like. Thank you, and have a great one. Have a good week. God bless. Goodbye.